Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore the impact investment industry, what it is, why it matters, and how it is playing a key role in reshaping how business is undertaken in many parts of the world. My name is Andrew Murray Watson. My guest today was responsible for the christening of the phrase impact investment into the world of global finance. Nick O'Donoghue is the Chief Executive of British International Investment, the UK's development finance institution and impact investor. BII invests between £1.5 and £2 billion every year in green infrastructure, technology and other sectors, and is currently partner to over 1,000 businesses and emerging economies with total assets of £7.5 billion. Nick was previously a senior advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and prior to that was the co-founder, alongside Sir Ronald Cohen, of Big Society Capital, the world's first social investment bank. Before that, he worked for 15 years at Goldman Sachs and then moved to JP Morgan, where he was global head of research. It was there 12 years ago he co-authored a research note entitled Impact Investments, an Emerging Asset Class, which is widely seen as firing the starting gun on what is now a $1 trillion industry. Nick, welcome to the Impact Equals podcast.
Thank you.
Can I start by asking you about your journey into impact investment and development finance? You spend nearly two decades working your way up through the ranks of two of the largest names of investment banking, so far so conventional, and then what happens?
Well, I think as you described in your introduction, I had a very traditional career, I suppose, in investment banking for the best part of 26, 27 years. I suppose that what really the pivot point for me was two things. I mean, first of all, was the global financial crisis. And I think the global financial crisis, more than anything else, illustrated the impact that the financial choices, the investment decisions, the asset allocation that all of us in the financial sector make has really profound implications on the world and how people live their lives. And I think that was a real wake-up call for many people. And certainly for me, although I suppose having been in the finance sector for a long time, you sort of know it, but it was still at the same time the sort of graphic illustration of the harm that can be caused by the sector when things aren't managed and regulated appropriately, I think was a shock for everybody. So that was one thing. And then sort of simultaneously with that, JP Morgan, where I was global head of research at the time, made a decision to start what we called a social sector finance group. And I suppose they were looking for something that Jamie Dimon, then still chief executive of JP Morgan, I think was very interested in pursuing. They had somebody, Christine Leon-Hoovered, who wanted to effectively set the business up, and they really needed somebody to supervise that, who was at a senior management committee level at JP Morgan. So that's how I got asked to supervise it, and that's what got me involved in impact investment. That was about 2008, I think, although we didn't call it impact investment at the time. And that led me to participate, for example, in the meeting that the Rockefeller Foundation organized in Bellagio, where a lot of these early foundations for impact investment, including the coining of the phrase, were laid. So that was where it started. And then I guess I became really fascinated by the idea of whether or not, indeed, we could, through intentionally targeting impact in our investment decisions, whether we could make a material difference to people's lives. And of course, as you said, I left JP Morgan subsequently, and we wrote the research report, which you referenced, which I think was quite influential at the time. And then I subsequently left to work with Sir Ronald Cohen to set Big Society Capital up, and then went to the Gates Foundation, and then had this opportunity to come to be the chief executive of what is now BII, what was then CDC in 2017.
Yeah, you referenced the note as being influential. I think that's, it was a fairly seminal note. So I think it's fair to say that some of your colleagues might have raised a quizzical eyebrow or two at the predictions for how fast the impact investment industry was going to grow. Those predictions have proven to be quite conservative in hindsight, haven't they?
Yeah, well, I think you're right to say that at the time, I think people were, I suppose, confused as to why we would spend time. And I say it was really a small group of people at JP Morgan, including Christine, including Yasmin Lamy, who now works with me at BII. And of course, the people from Rockefeller, particularly Anthony Bug-Levine, and with some help from the Global Impact Investment Network from GIN. And I think, there was definitely a question as to whether or not anybody would read a report on impact investment. And I think subsequent events showed that there was a huge amount of interest, of sort of latent interest in the subject. So it became a very popular popular report. And the estimates and the forecasts that we made around the growth of impact investment, likewise, I think people felt were very aggressive. And it turned out over the following decade that the impact investment movement or approach grew much more quickly than people thought. And that was, I think, a surprise to everybody. It was a surprise to us, but I think it's an indication of just how important it is to capture impact in your investment decisions.
Absolutely. So fast forward to BII. For the uninitiated, what is BII? What does it do?
So British International Investment is an organization that's actually 75 years old. It was created in 1948 by the UK government. It was the world's first development finance institution. And really what was identified at the time was the need to provide capital into developing countries to help particularly private sector companies grow so that they could create jobs, pay taxes, and increase overall prosperity in the country. And the reality is, if you don't have a growth in the private sector and a prosperous, a growing private sector, it's very difficult for countries to emerge from poverty. And the private sector can't grow unless it has access to capital. And in most of these countries, they don't have capital markets in the way that we have in developed countries. So somebody has to fill that gap, and that's filled by development finance institutions. So that was the journey that I suppose was originally CDC, the Commonwealth Development Corporation, subsequently BII. That was the journey that the organization began in 1948, and it's been going on for 75 years. Our first chairman, Lord Reith, who was also the founder of the BBC, when he was asked at the time what CDC was for, he said it was to do good without losing money. And I think that underlying mission of making a difference to development at the same time as preserving and hopefully earning a return on capital, that's really what's driven the growth of BII now for 75 years.
So BII was an impact investor before there was an impact investment industry. It's obviously evolved a great deal since it was founded. But what does impact really mean to the organization and to yourself personally?
Yeah, I think when we talk about impact, when we talk about development impact, we're talking about how we change the lives and the societies of the people who live in the countries and the societies in those countries in which we invest. And what we have a methodology that we use for doing that, which looks at every investment proposal, and as well as obviously doing the normal financial due diligence to ensure that what we're investing in is a sustainable company and hopefully with the opportunity for growth. We also look at every potential investment with a development impact lens. And that lens tends to look quite broadly we try to ask ourselves, you know, as I said, what difference will the company make to people's lives? How much difference will it make? Where will it make that difference? And we have a methodology that we use, a quantitative methodology that we use, that looks at really three different variables for each investment. One is productivity, the degree to which the investment will impact the affordability and accessibility of critical goods and services, the degree to which it will help to catalyze markets. We look at the sustainability of the investment to ensure that it is something that will help the transition which all countries have to go through, a greener economy and ultimately net zero. And we look at the inclusivity of the investment. So we ask ourselves, as I said, who is it reaching? Who is it going to make a difference to? And are they people that are from typically excluded parts of the population? So that can be obviously lower income members of the population. It can be other excluded groups, which historically have included women, for example.
And talk to me about the role of DFIs, because DFIs obviously have a key role to play in catalyzing markets, as you just mentioned. Where do DFIs sit, or where should they sit in the kind of the investment ecosystem as far as impact is concerned?
So look, I think DFIs were set up to do the difficult deals in the difficult places. So our responsibility, and also I suppose to be additional, so to do things that fill gaps that are left by commercial investors. So that's really what our objective is, and that's where the gaps that we fill. So where will you find DFIs? You'll find us in most of the sub-Saharan African countries, for example. If you go to those countries, you find there is a complete dearth of commercial investors, certainly international commercial investors. There's very little or nothing in the way of locally developed capital markets. So really the only people that bring capital to those markets are going to be development finance institutions, because that's our principal mandate. And that obviously requires us to be to take more risks than traditional commercial investors would. So if you look at where DFIs are on the risk spectrum, they're certainly, and benchmark them certainly against commercial investors, they're doing investments or making investment decisions and allocations that are certainly higher risk than normal commercial investors. I think the other thing importantly, which DFIs have done, is they've bought much higher standards in environmental, social, governance, sort of business integrity standards. And we've done that because obviously our markets require that. But in many respects, before it was fashionable to look at ESG characteristics before you made investments, DFIs were embedding that into all their investment decision making processes. So I think it's a very unique group. When we talk about DFIs too, we're typically talking about organizations like the IFC. We're talking about, although there are multilateral DFI and a whole host of bilateral DFIs.
Clearly, the sums of money, the volume of capital that the world needs to meet the UN Sustainable Development Goals is a mind-boggling sum. In an African context, it's only marginally less mind-boggling. And no one is disputing that capital needs to flow into Africa from developed economies. But increasingly, we hear about the need for DFIs and others to provide not just capital, but risk capital, to really play a kind of catalytic role in unlocking other sources of private finance. What's your view on that, particularly within a kind of an African context, and particularly within the kind of the least developed countries in Africa?
So it's clear, absolutely clear, that we cannot come anywhere close to addressing or reaching or achieving the SDGs without significant amounts of private capital. That issue is probably most pronounced in Africa, which has the greatest distance to travel, if you like, if they're to achieve the SDGs. So, if you look at, I think estimates range from how much capital do we need to achieve the SDGs, $3 to $4 trillion a year, how much actually comes, if you like, from official sources, it's probably more like 100 to 150 billion. So there's a huge gap that has to be filled, and it has to be filled by commercial investors. And DFIs and multilateral development banks can make a significant difference in helping to attract and mobilize that capital. And I think that's something we've done as a group to some extent over the last probably decade or more. But there's really a need now, I think, to step up to another level in terms of this sort of energy and urgency around how we mobilize. And there are some of that is just sharing more of the knowledge that we have, because we've obviously enormous experience in particularly, again, if we talk about Africa. BII, for example, have investments in 34 different countries in Africa. And as I said earlier, we've been doing it for 75 years. So that's a lot of experience in countries that commercial investors typically haven't got. So I think we need to share that. We need to be better at sharing the data on our investment returns. And some of it is challenging, to be honest. Some of it, on the other hand, is quite encouraging. I mean, when you look, for example, at project finance and infrastructure in Africa, where you'll find, if you look at the GEMS database, which captures that data, you'll find that actually the results are the risks are probably not as pronounced as people think. So we need to get much better at sharing that data. We need to be more creative about the financial structuring that we use to bring in commercial investors. They are all, many of them, challenged by capital requirements. We have to respect that, and obviously fiduciary requirements on behalf of their clients. And in many cases, in order to mobilize them, we're going to have to mitigate some of the risks they take. So I think we need to be more creative and innovative about that. Blended finance, which is sort of a broadly used term, means a lot, sometimes different things to different people, but ultimately means how do you bring together more concessionary capital, which I think is largely provided through, if you like, official sources like MNBBs and DFIs and sometimes foundations. How do you combine that with commercial capital to mitigate some of the risks that commercial capital takes and leverage in more a great deal more of their money?
Is there an argument, therefore, that the entirety of DFI money should be catalytic in that sense, in terms of de-risking the opportunity for private investors?
I think you have to find a balance. I don't think that the role of DFIs or MDBs should be exclusively to provide a subsidy. And let's be clear, that's largely what we're being asked to do. Not exclusively, but largely being asked to provide a subsidy to private sector investors. And I think there are limits on that. I also think there were some things where the degree of risk, some in transactions that we would enter into, where the degree of risk mitigation and sort of the cost of the subsidy, if you like, is at such a level that it just really doesn't make sense for us to use our precious concessionary capital in that way. So I think that particularly applies in some of the poorest countries in which we're active. So I think it's very important for the government-owned organizations to make a more conscious effort and be more incentivized to mobilize capital. That won't be their exclusive activity. And you know, there's a lot of different ways of mobilizing capital, and some are very direct, some are more indirect. So, for example, much of what we do is investing in places and industries and sectors to sort of demonstrate that investment can make sense and is sustainable. So that demonstration effect is typically done without any it takes place in cases where you cannot, by definition, mobilize or bring in other capital. I think we need to be continuing to do that sort of investment as well.
Obviously, the amount of money within the impact investment space is growing exponentially, which has to be fundamentally a good thing. As the industry gets bigger, does it lose some of its definition around the edges? I mean, I know from hearing you talk before that it is still the case that impact investment funds tend not to reach those very, very least developed countries in sufficient quantities. So how are you seeing the industry evolve, and how are you working to ensure that those countries and those communities that need development capital the most are still getting it?
Yeah, I think you're raising a couple of different questions there. I mean, one is whether or not we are sufficiently, the measurement and reporting and monitoring of impact is sufficiently robust. And I think from the very beginning of the impact investment movement, people have always highlighted that impact measurement question as being absolutely fundamental if the industry is to scale. I think we've made significant progress in terms of measurement and monitoring of impact. And you look at things like the Impact Management Project, which guides many, many institutions in terms of how they're investing. You look at some of the work that's been done, the Joint Impact Model, which is developed by the European Development Finance Institutions, IRIS, which is developed by GIN. These are all ways of trying to build a better and a more consistent taxonomy for impact investment and measuring and reporting impact. But we're not there yet. We look at sort of generally accepted accounting principles as being sort of the model that took 100 years to develop GAAP. And it's going to take a long time before we get to that point in impact. But that's clearly the direction we should go in. I think the other point you were raising is more around, if we look at the impact investment movement today, and regardless of how they're reporting impact, where's the money actually going? And I think one of the, I suppose, frustrations for those of us who are most active in emerging markets, and particularly in Africa, is that that continent has been, I'd have to say, in my view, largely untouched by impact investment, which is in a way perverse when you consider that is, as I said, the continent that has the largest distance to travel in terms of achieving the SDGs. And I think that's a function, to be fair, of risk, largely of risk. It's risky and difficult to invest in that in the continent. I mean, we should know, we've been doing it for 75 years. It's not impossible, certainly, to preserve capital and earn a return. But I think in many cases, it's difficult to justify that as what you would describe as a commercial risk-adjusted return. But on the other hand, impact investment is supposed to be about combining both financial return and impact. And there's certainly an enormous impact to be created through impact investment in Africa. So I suppose there have been large global impact investments funds set up that explicitly exclude investment in Africa, for example. And I think, as I say, I think that's a little perverse. And that's certainly a challenge for both the DFIs and the impact investment community to work, collaborate more together to try to address the enormous capital shortage that exists today in Africa.
Yeah. impact investment is a risky business by definition almost. To what extent is it, or is it even inevitable, that in some cases DFIs and others will fail?
Well, in any investment process, failure is some degree of failure is inevitable. You just want, hopefully, the good investment decisions to sort of outnumber your bad ones. As you said, what we do, what DFIs do, is in really, our mandate is to do the most difficult deals in the most difficult places. BII make about 65 different investments a year. We deploy up to $2 billion or more of capital. All our other major DFIs are doing the same thing. So it's inevitable you're going to make mistakes. And you hope that you learn from those mistakes, but definitely mistakes are inevitable.
At a kind of governmental level, particularly sort of in developed economies that where governments put a lot of money into capital DFIs, do you think there's an acceptance or growing acceptance that more risks have to be taken now?
Look, I think there has been a very substantial growth in development finance as part of the overall development offering from many of the major developed countries, including the United States and including across Europe. So development finance has grown significantly over the last 20, 25 years. Generally, the record has been if we talk about the financial record and performance of those institutions has been very good in the sense that they have earned positive returns. There's certainly been no solvency issues with any of them. So I think in many respects, that's validated the model. I think we've seen on the ground the enormous impact that growing private sector can have. So the underlying, I suppose, theory of change, that if you provide capital in a prudent way to private sector companies in poorer countries, that you can really make a difference to the level of prosperity in those countries. I think that, particularly when you look across Asia and some African countries, I think that model has been proven. We do have to be careful, and governments have to be careful to remember that sustainability of development finance institutions is a critical part of our model. So, I mean, I think there's always, when you're using government money, pressure on you. And I saw this in my previous life when I was at Big Society Capital, for example, where we were using government-directed dormant accounts. There's always pressure to, I suppose, be a lot more impact-oriented and to do that at the expense of financial sustainability. And I don't think that works. It doesn't in the long term. Sustainable development of finance institutions is critical to the success of the model. So I think we have to be, I think we've done a pretty good job over the previous 10, 20 years in finding a reasonable balance between financial sustainability and impact.
I mean, it may be a view that's held more in the UK and the US and Europe than it is actually in Africa, but I guess there's a view in some quarters that capital that flows into Africa from the UK, Europe, North America should be in some way free. I don't think that having spoken to many African entrepreneurs and business leaders, I don't think that's necessarily replicated to the same extent within African economies. What's your view? I mean, it's fundamentally what DFIs do involves a profit motive, doesn't it?
Yes. Look, I think there's obviously a difference between grants and investment. And grants are, and at least in the UK's case, probably 95% of the development budget is given in the form of grants. And that's money that you put in to create impact for humanitarian relief, for a whole host of different building social infrastructure, a whole host of different reasons in poorer countries, and you don't get any of it back. And that is, as I said, makes up probably 95% of development spending. And then you've got a much smaller part that's investment, where the sort of theory of change, as I said, is that you help private companies to grow, to create jobs, to pay taxes, and then that money is returned and you recycle it. I think if you look at African countries today, if you talk to political leaders in many of those countries, they will tell you that they want to move from more sort of grant-based development relief towards more investment-based relief. They want a hand up rather than a hand out. They want to see, they understand that long-term prosperity is going to come from growth, frankly, in the private sector. And that's only going to happen with the availability of capital. So I think there has been a pretty significant change. They also understand in many of these countries that their ability to take on debt at a government level, sovereign level, is severely constrained now. So that all that leads you to development finance and the need for investment and the need for investment and growth in the private sector.
Let's talk about growth in the context of the climate emergency and the SDGs particularly. Growth by itself is not the solution anymore, is it? I mean, for Africa or anywhere else. Looking at impact in that context, how do you filter your investment opportunities specifically in regards to kind of the climate emergency and everything that necessitates?
Well, let's be clear. Growth is absolutely fundamental to addressing the climate emergency. I mean, without growth in Africa, you won't be able to afford to build the sort of adaptation and resilience and all the things that you need to address what is the inevitability of climate change. And so growth is always going to be critically important. I think what has changed is we've got to decouple growth, that growth, from the growth in carbon emissions. And historically, for the last 200 years, and since the sort of beginning of the Industrial Revolution, those two things, economic growth and growth in emissions, have sort of gone hand in hand. And so that's the decoupling that needs to take place. And I think development finance institutions have a really important role in that. There's going to be a massive amount of capital that's needed to transition to a green economy, to achieve net zero. And I think much of it will have to be provided through private sector initiatives, which will require capital. So we in the development finance community have a really critical role to play in providing that finance. And I think our role, again, is not to provide some of the financing of climate mitigation, for example, so utility scale, solar and wind is becoming pretty commercial and needs certainly less concessionary kind of finance and probably less money from a development finance institution. So we need to move on and push the edge of the envelope, do the more difficult stuff in things like battery storage, things like green hydrogen, more in the way of adaptation and resilience, securing the water supply. So all of those things, I think, there's, again, massive amounts of capital that's going to be needed, both to adapt to and to mitigate climate change over the coming decades.
Interesting. So just going back to your original research note, you described impact investments as an emerging asset class. Has it now emerged, or is it still emerging? And what is it going to take from moving from being impact investments to just investments?
Well, I certainly think it's emerged relative to where it was in 2010, because it was sort of non-existent then and the term had never really been heard. So I think it has definitely emerged since then. We had a debate. I mean, there was a lot of talk of 3 or 4 years ago about reaching a pivot point. And I think to some extent, the industry has reached a pivot and it's much more mainstream now. The number of people involved, the amount of capital involved, every single investment institution. I remember actually saying this 10 years ago, the day will come when every single investment institution will have to have an impact investment funds and people working on impact investments. And mainstream investment capital sort of moves when they think they're missing something. And ultimately you would reach that point. And that's certainly where we are now. I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't find any major investment institution that doesn't have a some focus somewhere on impact investment.
But is that just because it's now just the hot asset class? It's for want of a better expression, the trendy asset class that everyone needs to be in the way that ESG was 10 years ago? Or is it really here to stay?
There is a degree of sort of trendiness about not just impact investment. Investments broadly, things become very hot and attract large amounts of capital. Typically, that has an impact on valuations. And then there's a sort of an evening or leveling off process over time. I don't see that sort of inflation, if you like, in the impact investment movement. I think it's more, and we had actually this debate for many years after this report was published, as to whether it's an asset class or a way of investment and a sort of a method for investment. And I think we all concluded in the end, it's really more of a way of investing money that says, look, I'm not just going to focus exclusively on financial returns, but I'm going to focus also on the impact that my investment portfolio or individual investments have on the climate or on people's lives. And so I think that's that embedding some form of impact question in your investment process, I think that's, I mean, it'll never be, there will always be people who will invest without any regard to its impact, and that's just inevitable. But I think in terms of what's more mainstream or accepted, I think we're very quickly coming to a point where some degree of focus on impact is considered to be sort of fundamental in an investment decision-making process. And sometimes that's quite lightweight, you know, I accept sometimes that because you're making a distinction between ESG and impact investment, I sort of more think of them as a continuum. I mean, you start with this idea that you don't want your investments to do no wrong. You want to, and then you move to an approach which focuses more on being more activist and in terms of working with companies to improve environmental and social standards. And then you move to a greater intentionality around impact investment. And that is a continuum. And I know people like to draw lines between the two, but actually what I think you see, what you've seen over the last 10, 12 years is people, more and more people moving along that continuum towards greater intentionality of impact.
Because I guess fundamentally people or investors haven't suddenly become nicer people over the last 10 years, have they? They're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. So what is the driving motivations? I mean, is it simply the recognition that the impact investing is a good is good business as well as being a good business?
Particularly when you think about a company's prospects from a risk perspective, if you are, and we've seen over the last decade that some of the most significant sort of value-destroying events that have affected companies have been driven by, you know, environmental or social or workforce issues. And so I think it's much clearer today that that has presents. These ESG challenges present enormous risks for your business. And we also see, I mean, I think this different generations or Gen Z or whatever they are, the sort of 20, my kids, basically. I mean, I think they are, you know, you have to talk to them to know they are much more concerned, and it drives their consumer decisions. It drives where they decide to go and work. And so that means if you're as a business, you just have to be cognizant of these factors. And if you don't, your business will underperform and your shareholders will underperform. So I think it is that recognition that it's critical for a successful business to manage and address these issues properly. There is also, I'd like to think there is at least some degree of altruism. I started by saying, highlighting the importance of the global financial crisis in terms of drawing attention to the sort of the impact that our investment decisions have on the world. And so I think there was a degree of, look, we don't want this to happen. We see the damage that can be done by ignoring these impacts. Every day we see the damage to the climate that's being created by many decades of companies really looking on sort of putting no value on their emission levels. So I think there is a lot of different things that have gone on in the last 10 years that have driven people towards impact investment. Some of it is a degree of altruism, I think. And also the belief that, you know, if you're managing a pension fund, you're managing a pension fund for people who might retire in 20 or 30 or 40 years. Well, they've got to have a world to retire into. There's no point in making a financial return and then finding that the climate change has made the Earth an impossible place to live in 40 years. So I think those are, so it's a sort of a nuanced issue, but it's multiple different things, I think, that again have led to this significant change in how people approach their investment portfolios.
Well, maybe every investor needs at least two teenagers in the boardroom to help shape their investment decisions.
Exactly, they'd be different. We come to different conclusions, I think, sometimes.
Nick, just lastly before we wrap up, and we're asking all our guests on the Impact Equals series the same question. What are the kind of the two or three major trends that are going to shape the industry over the next few years?
Yeah, so I think the major trends in, if we look at the next few years in impact investment are, I think in terms of what we're, sort of investment opportunities, I think you're going to see a lot, obviously continued growth in climate. The amount of money required, capital required is in the, you know, trillions of dollars. I think you're going to see continued investment in technology, and we have a a venture capital portfolio of BII, trying to invest in those companies that are using digital technology to provide solutions and reach markets that historically haven't been reachable in a sustainable way by the private sector. I think you'll see a much greater rise in gender lens investing. And BII was instrumental in starting the 2X challenge about 3 or 4 years ago with a couple of our peer DFIs. And that's been enormously successful in driving more money towards women-owned businesses. And I think you'll see the same thing back actually on diversity and equity. I think a much more conscious efforts, for example, in Africa to drive money towards Black-owned businesses. And that's something that we do at BII through what we call our BOLD program. So those trends will continue. I mean, in the industry as a whole, you'll continue to see focus on reporting, and reporting will continue to improve. I think we'll see more conscious verification. So the sort of work that organizations like Bluemark do, I think will continue to grow. I think we talked a little bit earlier about blended finance and this idea of collaboration across commercial investors, perhaps development finance institutions and foundations. I think that blended finance is probably still in its infancy. Growth and scaling are difficult because of the very bespoke nature of a lot of these transactions, but it's definitely continued to grow. Look, I hope that one of the key trends also will be a much greater focus on emerging developing markets, particularly Africa. Because I think if you look at the impact investment industry as a whole today, it is dominated by very limited percentage goes into the African continent. And really, again, when you look at the SDGs and what we need to do to achieve those SDGs, that needs to be a much larger amount. So I hope that will also be a willingness to take more risk in pursuit of impact, particularly in Africa. I hope that will also be one of the trends.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us on the Impact Equals podcast. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Until next time.